A little mystery music to get us started today on the show. If you're a fan of Agatha Christie, you know that food plays a role in her mystery books. And tell you what, our next guest has a great novel, a great book out that's going to talk about Agatha Christie mysteries. Our guest, Karen Pierce. She's a detective fiction devotee, a food lover, Agatha Christie super fan, and her new book is Recipes for Murder, 66 Dishes That Celebrate the Mysteries of Agatha Christie. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Do you like mysteries that include great food in the copy? Do you have a question about some of the food mentioned in Christie's books? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email. Email address, ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Karen Pierce, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us, and happy birthday.
Thank you, and happy Halloween to you.
What's it like to have your birthday on Halloween?
Well, you know, at different times of life, it's different. As a kid, it was great. As a teen and in my 20s, it was fabulous. It was pretty boring in my 30s when everybody had little kids and we all just trick-or-treated. But, it's a great day to be born.
Well, I tell you what, you've written a great little book here, too. I really enjoyed going through it. How'd you come up with the idea for it?
Well, honestly, I was searching the internet for the Agatha Christie cookbook and couldn't find one. I collect cookbooks, and I could not find one, and I just thought that was astonishing. So I just started writing one.
You know, and not only Agatha Christie, but many authors. Do you enjoy other authors who use food in their books?
Yeah, no, of course. There's a Nero Wolfe cookbook, and there's a Lord Peter Wimsey cookbook, and lots of the modern writers have their amateur chefs as their amateur detectives as chefs. And so food is working its way into mystery in a big way.
And I think, and Agatha Christie is probably one of the first ones to do that. I wonder if it's kind of an extension of what Agatha Christie did.
Kind of, yeah, because in some of her novels, she really does talk a lot about food, and she offers up one or two wonderful recipes that I've tried to incorporate here, and, you know, the delicious death cake and that she's most famous for. So, yeah, lots of food in Christie. And she used food not just, you know, here's a recipe, but it was more like she used it to characterize people. She used it as a plot point, and she used it to set the tone and the culture of the mystery. So, yeah, she used it a lot. She used food a lot, not always as specifically as I would have liked for when I was writing this book. But I certainly had a lot of fun trying to dream up and figure out which a recipe or which dish or which thing to concentrate on in each book.
Yeah, you didn't mention it, but food is a weapon, too, sometimes. In her
book. Of course. I mean, without saying, she poisoned a ton of people.
Well, I tell you, I really enjoyed how you put this book together, going decade by decade of her life, which is, you think about it, the 20s through into the 70s.
Yeah. She wrote a lot and for a long time, and that's why I chose to do it that way, to show each decade, because the food changes. Who's making it changes, where it's being served changes, how it's made changes. A very obvious one in here to demonstrate that is Murder on the Links, which is a very early 1920s book. There's a lovely steak that is fried in 8 tablespoons of butter. No kidding, right? By the 40s, when he's having a nice, steak and frites, now we're only frying with about 3 tablespoons of butter. And by the time you get to the 60s, 70s, you know, I'm showing you a steak that's, you know, marinated and grilled on a charcoal grill in the Caribbean, and a completely different way of doing things. So, yeah, everything changed. It was in her lifetime. Think about it. I mean, nobody really had cars when she was young, but they all had servants. And now, as she became quite old, it was quite the turnaround. Everybody had a car, and almost nobody had servants anymore.
Yeah, it was really interesting to me how you started each decade with some comments on the decade itself, and then for each of the recipes, you're commenting on the books there, the things that she's written, and then how that sort of works into the recipes that you come up with, And by the way, these are not the original recipes with the necessarily the 10 tablespoons of butter. These are recipes that any of us can make, which I really appreciate, and I found many in your book that I want to try myself.
Absolutely. Like, who knew that, you know, Oysters Rockefeller was so easy? I mean, I was really surprised by a few of them. I really tried to make it home cook. Like, nothing is more than a page, really. And it's all got to be stuff that, you know, wanted it really to be accessible. So anybody can try one of these fun recipes for their next murder mystery dinner.
Yeah. I've done a murder mystery dinner, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, they are, aren't they?
Oh, they're a lot of fun. And you mentioned Oysters Rockefeller, and you have a nice little aside in the book, as I'm remembering now, that of how Oysters Rockefeller came to be.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that a great little story? He'd run out of snails.
The chef had run out of snails.
So next best thing, then, oysters, which, you know, hardly seems the same to me, but that's great. And then named it after the head of Standard Oil. So, yeah, I really like that story, too. Oysters Rockefeller from New Orleans.
If we look at the 20s, as you describe it, it was sort of the end of the war, the jazz age, and you talk about the criterion was, I think, good food with the, subtlety of flavors and contrast?
Right. It's Arabella Boxer, the Book of English Food. The criterion of good food was subtlety of flavor and contrast, combined with that perfection of simplicity, which is the hardest thing to achieve. So, yeah, I mean, what she was talking about is initially only wealthy people had good food because they had access to the best food, but also to the best, you know, chefs and cooks and things like that. And in the 20s and 30s is when a lot of those chefs and cooks left the large estates and started to open restaurants, and thereby, you know, giving a lot of access to the same good food to the middle classes.
Yeah. I kind of like the peach melba recipe, and that was named after an opera singer, wasn't it?
Yes, an Australian opera singer.
Nellie Melba? Nellie Melba, I think it was. And there again, this is a pretty straightforward recipe.
Mm-hmm. Again, yeah. Who knew?
How did you decide?
Who knew? I mean, you think of peche melba as being something really difficult to do or make, and it's really quite simple. It's like in 3 steps,
And away you go.
Oh, a very lovely dessert. I know.
Well,
maybe
I'm making
you'll
that.
Enjoy that.
I'm making that for sure. How did you decide which recipes to include? Because there's food in some, as you say, there's food in practically all of Agatha Christie's work.
Well, you've kind of, you know, put your finger on it. One, I wanted it to be an accessible recipe. So, you know, lobster Americana is not very accessible. So in that case, I picked the Peshmerga. But I also try to do things that, you know, would be of interest to people in what is that, you know? Like, there's a lot of cultural difference between America and Britain, and also a lot of time difference. I mean, these things, some of these things are from the 20s. I mean, when was the last time you saw Peshmerga on a menu? You know, yeah. These are, so some of these things are kind of a little outdated and stuff, and I thought I'd bring them back and tell people what they were. So anybody who's read her stories and said, I wonder what that is, now they might find out. A good example of that is in the Sittaford mystery, which I'm not really sure. That I know there's a different, Murder on Hazelmere, I think is the American title for that one. But she talks about a coffee cake. Now, I know most American readers think a coffee cake is a cake with, you know, maybe some fruit and crumbles and cinnamon, and you literally have it with your coffee. But coffee cake in Britain is really just another flavor of cake. You could have a chocolate cake, a vanilla cake, or a coffee cake, or, yeah, so it's just a cake, but flavored with sort of coffee extract, I guess.
Yeah. Well, since you're mentioning coffee cake, you start with a recipe for coffee.
Yes,
and actually end with one, too.
Yeah, that's kind of my little ode to Stiles, because the mysteries start and end at Stiles as well. Yeah, so coffee is interesting, and in almost every one of her books, people have a cup of coffee. So I thought coffee was a great place to start. And it's very interesting because, you know, this is just a little before electricity is in everybody's home. So these were the first introduction of a coffee percolator, not an electric one, but one on your stove. And so the wealthiest people in the wealthiest homes, like Stiles, would have had a coffee percolator. And yet the immigrants coming from Europe probably were still using the filtered method, which today still they use that. So at the end of the book, I'm talking about the electric percolator and people still using the drip method. As like, it's interesting, but there's been a whole new resurgence in coffee over those 70 years, quite significantly.
So how do you make a perfect cup of coffee?
Well, in my house, you start with the freshest beans, and you grind them on site, and I use a French press. But, yeah, when I want to do it perfectly, I do drip. I just let it slowly, you know, filter through and take its time. And if I really want the best coffee, I go to my corner coffee shop, and they make great coffee.
Karen Pierce, our guest today, she is the author of Recipes for Murder, 66 Dishes That Celebrate the Mysteries of Agatha Christie. Questions for her? Maybe you got a question about food in an Agatha Christie novel, or maybe just a question about one of Agatha Christie's novels. I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Do you like to read about food in a mystery? Give us a call or shoot us an email. Trina LaSousa is our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us today on this Halloween. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Karen Pierce, the author of Recipes for Murder, 66 Dishes That Celebrate the Mysteries of Agatha Christie. Questions or comments for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800 642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Did you do the, by the way, you did the recipe testing and all that yourself? What was that process like?
That was a lot of fun and took a long time. I do have three helpers that helped a lot. So when I would find a recipe either in my own collection or through one of my old cookbooks or wherever I found them, I would then try it and adjust it, and then I would send it off to one of my friends, to one of these three, to also try it so I can make sure that everybody, that what I was writing was doable, right? I mean, most of us, when we have our own recipes in our own collections, just, you know, a dab of this, a dash of that, and just a little bit, oh, no, I don't use that anymore. And, you know, so I had to really be very disciplined a bit and measure everything and be very careful about it. So that was part of the process. Finding the recipes was also, you know, quite exciting, and because sometimes I have no idea. So I would scour menus from restaurants of the time or on train cruises or ship cruises and what they were serving the first class and the second class, and get my ideas from there and then research them. And, you know, the one, castle puddings, which is a little cake, because pudding does a lot of work in British cooking. But this is a little cake, and I think we tried maybe 3-4 different versions of that particular one before we got one that satisfied us. So lots of trial and error. Some things, like I tried to make pita bread as they would have done, you know, 1,000-2,000 years ago, but without yeast or yogurt or anything, I couldn't do it. So it's not in the book. So lots of fun adventures like that. We did find pheasants at a wildlife butcher or mm-hmm. something in the market here. So I did try a pheasant and cooked it, and it was absolutely, partridge, I mean, it was absolutely lovely, and I'd highly recommend people try that. But yeah, no, it was a great adventure, and I do acknowledge and thank the hard work of some of my friends and family, all, you know, testing, and I had many, many dinner parties where people would come and be guinea pigs. And yeah,
it sounds like quite a process. I mean, did you come on any? Did you find any culinary history that surprised you, or you were able to discover? I mean, you've talked about a few things, I think, but
well, let's talk about the a pocket full of rye and 420 blackbirds baked in a pie. I so wanted to just include the story of that, which is in medieval castles, the chefs would make this huge pie pastry on sort of scaffolding and fill it with live birds, put a top on it, and roll it into the center of the feasting area, take off the top, and all the birds would fly out and sing, and wasn't that a dainty dish to set before the king? So I love that story. I just wanted to put it in like that. But he said, no, 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 Karen, you must have a recipe. So I had to go digging and find a blackbird pie recipe, which, of course, right now is illegal. You're not allowed to shoot songbirds and put them in pies. So I found it in the 1800s. They did do that. So I tried and I made the pie. I used Cornish hens. And it was quite interesting and delightful, really, in its own way. So that's probably the oldest and the funniest of recipes that I tried.
You know, a lot of Christie fans are going to recall reading about vegetable marrows. And what the heck are vegetable marrows? What are they?
Well, they're from the zucchini family. So the friend of mine that found that recipe and did it is actually British, And so she lives in the Netherlands. So she found it and found Amaro, because they still have them over there, and she made that recipe. And, yeah, every Brit knows stuffed marrows. It's one of those basic things that your mom always made. So here, you know, if you've gone to a farm stand, you've probably seen an overgrown zucchini. Not those little tiny ones we get in the grocery stores, but those great big ones you find. And that would be the closest thing.
Yeah.
Poirot did retire to grow the perfect vegetable marrow. And I can't even imagine why, because...
Well, he Marot was obsessed with food, in most of the various obsessed with food in most of the books mm-hmm. that he served.
Why vegetable marrow? They're really bland and boring.
Well, I can tell you right now that there are plenty of us here in Wisconsin and elsewhere that have zucchini that would fit right in.
There you go. Well, you try that recipe with a zucchini and let me know how it goes, because that's how I made it as well.
Yeah.
With a big zucchini that I got at a farmer's market, and it was really fun and delightful. Yeah, I think you'll really enjoy it.
Do you think Perrault and his obsession with food, is that kind of a reflection of Christie, of the author?
I don't know, because, you know, when she invented Ariadne Oliver, who is sort of her, you know, character double in the books, Mrs. Oliver is a mystery writer herself, and her detective is Norwegian and a vegetarian. And she often complains that she made him a vegetarian when she doesn't even know anything about vegetarianism. So I often wondered whether Christie did love food or not. Maybe she just made him a gourmand and then regretted it. But in truth, Mrs. Christie, Agatha Christie, was a total foodie. She really liked good food. Whether it was fresh cream or lobster or caviar, she really liked good food, and she was a good cook too.
She wrote about fish and chips came up quite a bit in her books. Mm-hmm. Actually, in the third, I think and you have a really nice fish and chips recipe in the book. Mm-hmm. I looked at it and I thought, I'm gonna try that too.
It's the double cooking of the fries. It's always the secret.
Yeah, and she. I think she started the big trend of fish and chips in England.
Not quite, but she certainly wrote about it fairly early on, and probably led to it becoming one of the national dishes. Absolutely.
Well, mac and cheese is also very popular here.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a classier name for it in the ABC Murders. Tell us about that.
Well, that's the British do use the sort of French version of a lot of things like that. I'm trying to think here, what did I actually call it? but that is the whole idea of mac and cheese did come from France, mixing it up and au gratin, right, with the cheese and the crumble on the top and making it a little bit fancier. So it wasn't really like, you know, mac and cheese at that point. It was still a very ladies who lunch dish.
So World War II how did World War II affect Christie's use of food in her novels?
Well, you know, we didn't live through this as much over here, but over there, rationing. I mean, lots of rationing, and with the blockades and stuff. I mean, England is a very tiny island, and they don't have a lot of the imports and stuff. So rationing and the black market and all those things really impacted how people how people ate and how they traded with their neighbors. And, of course, A Murder is Announced is a wonderful book that really gets right into how the neighbors and neighborhoods and villages dealt with this whole idea. You know, well, I've left you some quince jam on your counter. Thanks for the leg of lamb last week. And, you know, it's really... really shows you what the Brits were going through. It's quite fascinating. And one of the dishes I talk about in Taken, I believe it's Taken at the Flood, we talk about Windsor stew. Now, this is a really old dish loved by George II and George III and IV, I believe, were the big lovers of Windsor stew. So Windsor soup stew, it's made from the things that are around Windsor: beef, lamb, parsnips, potatoes, and was a really lovely, delightful thing. But during the war, with all the cutbacks and everything, it became kind of a brown, liquidy soup of very little flavor, according to Poirot. And... other people have testified to this, too. During the war years, it just became really watery and boring and really lost its luster. So when I dug down and found the actual recipe, it's quite delightful once you have everything for it. You're not, you know, in the middle of a war. So, yeah, the war was really hard on Brits, and probably one of the reasons that, you know, they were known at that time for having very boring food. Well, that's because not a lot of spices and stuff from all over the world was getting into Britain at that time.
Yeah. Thinking about this, I can't remember. It might have been from the 30s. The three-act tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Christie murders.
That's one where she kills everybody. With food.
Yeah, food is used as a weapon
in all three murders.
And then you do have a recipe, one that I'm going to try, a sage and onion stuffing. And that's from Cards on the Table of Perrault.
Yes, and that's actually a... that's from the aforementioned Adriana Oliver's detective. And he's trying to decide, you know, what to do about these poisoned beans, which are with the Michaelmas goose. But then she realizes that the beans are out of date because they would have been an earlier summer dish. And anyway, it's all very confusing. But yes, sage and onion and bread stuffing.
And
it's
the onion,
nice.
I like the way, in that recipe in particular, that you've got the onions on the stove a long time. And that's what you need to do to really bring out the flavor.
Exactly. And to cut down on the bitterness as well. So it's really, you really get, it's almost like caramelizing them, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's lovely. And I thought, all right, I'll try that one too. And then there were none. Is probably her greatest novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it sold 100 million or over 100 million
yep.
copies. And you talk about how food changes throughout the course of that novel.
Yeah. Isn't that clever of her? Yeah, it's wonderful. They start off that novel with all of them at dinner, and it's being served, and it's the best wines, and she talks about it's the best foods, and, you know, they have a cook and a server, and it's just, you know, the top and the most exclusive of everything. And by the very end, when there's like just one or two of them, they're eating out of cans in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You know, just popping the top off that Spam and going for it.
Yeah.
So really, yeah. And so what I did was I sat and I thought, well, what's halfway between those? Where were we at, you know, when there's still five left, you know? And that's when I, you know, read the bit about the boiled potatoes, and I thought, you know, that really is, because you're not just chewing on raw potatoes at this point or out of a can. You're actually taking a little bit of time to cook them, but they're not au gratin or scalloped as they would have been earlier on.
The some other recipes that I just want to mention, and you mentioned earlier the chocolate cake.
Mm-hmm.
That looks really, really good and not all that difficult to make.
Exactly, yeah. No, the to die for cake, which is part of, and the murder is announced, she talks about collecting, because of the rationing and the black market, all the different ingredients. Well, Jane Asher, a very famous British cook, made that cake from that description. And I don't think she's copyrighted it, but I wanted to have a different cake. I didn't want to use Jane's. So that's actually a special chocolate cake from my own collection. And, yeah, I have espresso instead of raisins. I think it's really lovely.
I want to get back to a little bit of how much I enjoyed how you sort of talked about the various mysteries at the various points in Agatha's career, and then sort of, so we get a real inkling as to why you used a particular recipe. But at the same time, for me, it brought out many, or at least some, of the books that of Christie that I hadn't read. Because you give us a kind of a clue. One, for example, and I'm a golfer, and I hadn't read Murder on the Links.
Or Why Didn't They Ask Evans? Which is
Why Didn't They Ask Evans
there.
Was the other one that have I not read those? So I'm going to be reading those. So,
oh, and that's what I really hope people, aside from trying out some of these recipes or looking through the book to see what the recipe is for your favorite, Christie, is that it tempts you to go past the big three, the big five that everybody's read, and read some of the smaller, lesser Christies that are just as delightful and as much fun to read as well. Like you say, the golf ones. There you go. A lot of golf in Christie's life.
Yes, there was.
In fact, I think that's what she said to her second husband before she married him. Tell me, do you like golf? And he said, golf what? And she said, fine, let's get married.
Oh, man. Well, here we are, Halloween. I would really be remiss by not mentioning, the period of the 60s, a time of prosperity, I think, in England and here as well. And you had jack-o'-lantern deviled eggs,
mm-hmm.
a Halloween, what a describe.
Treat.
A Halloween treat. Of course, it still actually wouldn't be too late to make it. But what's in there? And that's on page 146 of your book, I think it is.
Yeah, well, that's just, it's really straight up deviled eggs. But I've encouraged you, well, add a little fruit coloring and a little bit of the top of an onion, but always. For the making the mouth and the eyes, I found I just got, you know, sort of, I bought dark brown, I guess, icing in the little tubes, so, you know, it would be very exact, because it's really hard to do otherwise, let me tell you. But, yeah, I mean, and deviling is such a British thing to do. They devil eggs, and they devil kidneys, and all sorts of different things. So I really wanted to make sure that got in as a savory treat for Halloween.
And I did want to...
Quite different to us. They do have, they kind of have, in Britain, they would have a Halloween party for certain age groups, and they would do all those things like the dunking of the apples and, you know, looking for your true love in the mirrors and things like that. Far less of the trick-or-treating culture, which we have here in North America.
Yeah, yeah. One other recipe that I wanted to include was the Jolly Roger cocktail.
Yeah.
For Evil Under the Sun. It and sounds pretty darn good.
That served at my Halloween special, that menu that I put in the back, the Jolly Roger cocktail. Yeah, that was fun. And the history of it was fun, too. Who knew that it actually was a pirate drink, that, you know, they decided to add fruit juice to rum so the pirates wouldn't all die of scurvy. Isn't that a wonderful, that's just such a great story. So next time you're having your rum and orange or whatever, or, you know, the Jolly Roger cocktail, you can just say, hey, my doctor told me to.
you do have at the end of the book, you do have Christie for Christmas, the Agatha Christie buffet. And these are all recipes, of course, from the book.
Yeah, so I do a little menus, you know, breakfast with the Bantries, and you know, so if that's what you wanted to celebrate, here's a little bit of an idea of how you can do that.
And it's just amazing to me, her career. I mean, she was writing in the 20s, 1920s, and still had something coming out in the 1970s.
No kidding, isn't it something? She was so prolific. When you think of she did, there's 66 mystery novels, but there's 140 short stories. There's something like 30 plays, six of the Mary Westmacott novels, and I'm going to say like there's at least three of her autobiographies. I mean, she had the official autobiography and Come Tell Me How You Live, and then about her whole journey around the world in the 20s. So amazingly prolific.
And died in 1976 at the age of 85.
Yeah.
Well,
just
amazing.
An amazing woman. And, you know, when you think that she's up there with the Bible and Shakespeare and how many books she's sold, quite an accomplishment for a middle-class woman from Britain.
Yeah. And you've written a great book, Karen. I want to thank you so much. I'm going to be digging into some of those books that I and stories that I hadn't read of hers, but I'm also going to be trying out at least I've got six or seven written down for now that I'm going to be trying out recipes.
Well, good luck with them, and I hope you enjoy them. And I really hope you do get to read some more. And I think you'll totally enjoy Murder on the Lynx.
I will certainly. That's probably my next effort. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Karen Pierce is the author of Recipes for Murder. Recipes for Murder, 66 dishes that celebrate the mysteries of Agatha Christie's Recipes for Murder. She was fun to talk to, for sure. And you know what? We're going to continue talking about mysteries and some of the brand new mysteries out there to read with our next guest, Joanne Berg, founder and owner of Mystery to Me Bookstore in Madison. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.